Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and sing it from the rooftops. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and this is another actual play episode where instead of covering one mechanic, we cover one moment from an actual play. This week, like last week, that moment is from the show My First Dungeon. This time, it's their Wild Sea miniseries, and to break it down, I am joined by two of the creators of My First Dungeon, Elliot Davis and Brian Flaherty. Elliot and Brian are the co-hosts of the RPG interview podcast Talk of the Table and two of the co-founders of Many Sided Media. You might be familiar with them because this podcast is on the Many Sided Podcast Network. Elliot is also a game designer under his brand More Blueberries, and he's got a new game out today. The time we have a game about two brothers, one of whom is turning into a zombie and one of whom is not, which you play by sitting on opposite sides of a closed door and answering prompts. Gonna have to cover this fucking game on this show. But let's get into the Wild Sea. I've covered the game before, but this is a game where you play as sailors on a sea of trees in a climate post-apocalypse where the climate won. And in the My First Dungeon miniseries of this game, Brian, as a player, took it on himself, along with co-player Jay Stroutman, to write an original song, a tree shanty, if you will, for each episode, which they then performed on the episode. And in the particular tree shanty moment we cover today, we get to see a moment that blends pre-production, production at the table, and post-production all together in a bunch of compelling ways. We also get to see some lessons on display about how to pace a campaign, and how when you know you can trust your fellow players, you can take more creative swings with them. So let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon, and here are Elliot Davis and Brian Flaherty with a Wild Sea tree shanty. Elliot and Brian, thanks so much for being here on Dice Exploder.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So I wanted to start like more broadly with actual play. I kicked off this series with an episode with Rowan Zioli where we spent a lot more time on like, what's the deal with actual play? Like, but I'm curious to hear y'all answer, what's the deal with actual play? Like when I say actual play, when you're thinking about it as a medium, like to the standard tabletop audience, to like your audience, what's the median actual play look like in your mind?
I mean, just starting from like a definition space, it is improvised narrative storytelling using a game as a narrative vehicle. And that's just a bunch of words to say, hey, we're going to play a game and we're going to record it with a eye towards an outside audience, or at least the way that we do it, always with an eye towards the outside audience, and are allowing ourselves to give over some narrative control to random polyhedral nameless and careless gods that are the dice or whatever other mechanic we may be using.
Yeah, I would agree with everything Brian said, and I would add that I think it's when artistic intention meets game mechanics. I think that actual play broadly is when you take like people who want to make some kind of artistic product or entertainment product, and they say, I'm going to use a game in some way to do that.
Yeah.
And I think broadly you can apply that definition to 90% of what people are considering actual play.
Yeah, so I'm really curious with My First Dungeon in particular. My understanding of the show is that one of the main intentions of it is also to like offer people a chance to like learn how a game works. You know, you're kicking off these series with like interviews with the designer and doing a lot of like recap and checking in after the fact. And all of that feels in service of that. But that feels like you have kind of two goals that maybe not in conflict with each other, but are not the same, right? Like of teaching people and entertaining people. And I'm curious to hear y'all just like talk about that push and pull in your experience making the show.
Oh boy, if we've been talking about this a lot internally.
We talk about it a lot.
Because you're not wrong. They are in conflict with each other. Because a lot of times we've built with ourselves, the format of our show is that, for anyone who's not familiar with My First Dungeon, the format is we do a season focusing on a new indie role-playing game. So like Orbital Blues or Zabe's Bed and Breakfast or Die. The first episode, the designer of that game teaches the GM how to play, gives them a bunch of tips and tricks. Then that GM who's never run the game before runs the game for new and experienced players. We add in like, you know, award-winning sound design and original music by Behold and other musicians. And then at the end of the series, we go back and talk to the designer about like what went right, what went wrong, how we can make things even better. Mm-hmm. And that is a format, but it is also very much a cage.
I'm familiar.
Right? Because every time, as we've gone on, this show was initially designed to like, my girlfriend at the time, my wife, wanted to learn to like GM. So we started a show where I like taught her how to the rules of Dungeons and Dragons. And now it is this like big, bold thing that we want to keep doing more and more expansive and wild things with. But the problem is, the more experimental and weird we get, the further we get from teaching people the core way of how to play the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think about this idea that there is like a spectrum that we slide around on with My First Dungeon between educational and aspirational. And I don't think that either is more explicitly valuable for bringing a game to the table. I think that the longer we've done this, the more I do truly think, and this isn't just justifying the way the show has gone, I do truly think that sometimes aspirational actual play can be more effective for getting people to bring a game to the table and try it than purely educational actual play.
I agree.
Because I think that, you know, you can lose people if you go too... It's harder to find the balance of, like, what level is my audience going to be at from an educational perspective. Like, you teach a kid differently than you teach an adult who plays games versus an adult who doesn't play games. And like with aspirational, you can make something really cool that highlights what makes this system interesting, and you keep enough mechanics in for them to then recognize it when they bring it to the table, and you've done the job of like, hey, now that person is excited to bring to the table and try and kind of create something similar to what we've used the game to create.
And the aspirational part is part of the reason why we do intense sound design and scoring and like highly editing. And it's part of that is it's fun. It creates a better product from our perspective. But really what we're trying to recreate is the sensation of playing the game. Because when you're playing a role-playing game,
I was just about to underline this 100%.
Right?
Yeah.
You hear the score in your head. Like that, the 5 minutes it takes for someone to look up a rule and roll the dice, that feels like it happens in 10 seconds because that's like, you know, you're going crazy. You're reading your character sheet, trying to figure out what the hell you're doing next. But in a recording, that's just dead air.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly obvious. So we cut that out partially to make a faster show that moves quicker, but also to better recreate what you would experience playing this game. So that, as Elliot said, this is aspirational, but also gives you a great glimpse into what playing this game could be like, which will hopefully get you to pick up the game and actually try it after you've, you know, learned the rules from the designer themselves.
Yeah. You know, I'm really interested in the dichotomy in this and also in actual play at large between nonfiction and fiction, right? Because you're sort of operating on those two different levels, right? On the nonfiction level, you have like the players sitting around the table, maybe learning how to play the game. And then on the fiction level, you have, you know, the story and the audio drama and all that kind of stuff. And I feel like balancing those things is something that is really tough in any kind of after the fact like media that comes from playing games, including like traditional actual play, but it's also like something that I think rarely gets thought about intentionally. And I'm curious to hear how y'all think about it.
I think it's an interesting thing because I think that there are, and so I'm going to be self-indulgent for a moment and talk about a new job that I've taken on these recent months. Is I just started teaching podcasting at a university here in New York. And one of the first things I talked about in that class was the idea that making a podcast, and I think this applies to actual play, making a podcast is thinking about where you land on multiple spectrums of creative choice. Mm-hmm. And one of those spectrums that you just brought up is fictionality.
Yeah.
Whether we're sitting in the fiction and the nonfiction, and in podcasting, that is somewhere where you can sit in kind of all the different places. And I never really thought about, until you just said it now, talking about play as nonfiction, but it 100% is. The more play you leave in, the more you are putting nonfiction into the product or into the podcast. So I don't know that we think about fictionality necessarily in My First Dungeon. I think we're often thinking fiction first when we're making our show. But I think it's the idea of like every single actual play, I think you can set out these creative spectrums and say, where did this person decide to land on it? Editing, number of people who you're hearing, like how much of the game is shown, how fictional it is, how sound design it is. These are all like spectrums of creative choice. And that's kind of the reason there's so much beautiful variety of podcasts and actual play is that you get to just turn those dials. And like, as we've learned over time, you get to adjust those dials as you go.
Yeah.
Where like we have cranked up our sound design and production value dial and probably cranked down the nonfiction dial in that way.
Yeah.
And I think our show, especially as a season goes on, so like our Wild Sea season was 6 episodes. And in the interview, obviously that's very nonfiction. In the first episode, it is incredibly fiction forward, but the first episode or two is where you're going to get the most like cut-ins from me as the GM, like explaining the rules or like teaching someone a thing and like we're learning how to play. And by the last episode, we're probably not getting any of those because we now have like learned the core rules. We're playing fully within the world. Now it's fully in the aspirational, inspirational story, like 100% story dial. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we go to the talk back with the creator, and then now it's 100% back to the nonfiction dial.
Yeah.
But I think that also beautifully mirrors how people learn games.
Totally.
You know? Like, I feel like when you look at your first session of a game and how much you're, like, looking at your character sheet and asking for rules clarifications versus your 10th session when you're barely thinking about the roles, you're barely thinking about the mechanics, I think that that is one of the beautiful things we've been able to capture in these more fiction-forward seasons, like The Wild Sea, like Orbital Blues, is that it feels like those players are learning to play because they are.
Yeah.
And like they're doing it on like, you know, a professional level, you could say, but it's exactly how it will kind of ramp when you bring the game home.
Yeah.
And also having the like we do talkbacks for each episode on our Patreon, which is just one way for me to plug the Many Sided Media Patreon. Go to patreon.com/manysidedmedia if you want to become a member of our Patreon. We have, you know, cast talkbacks for each episode, which A is just kind of like part of the format of actual play these days. Like Dimension 20 has their talkback show. I know Critical Role does. It's an easy bonus content thing. But when you are a show that is so focused on teaching people, that becomes a great way for us to twist the dial one way or the other of the episode ends up being very heavily fiction. And then the talkback ends up being very heavily nonfiction.
Where that's interesting.
Some of what we're talking about is story forward, but a lot of it ends up being like, oh, that game mechanic worked a little differently than I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, wasn't that interesting that this worked and this didn't?
Yeah, you're like separating out the fiction and the nonfiction layers into different episodes, or trying to some extent there, maybe.
Yeah, and I think there's a blending between
totally.
Each. Like, you'll find some fiction in the talkbacks, and you'll find some nonfiction in the core episodes. But part of that is also us coming up against that cage that I talked about. Because if we were sticking to the like most core idea of what my first dungeon was originally intended to be, there would be way more interruptions by the GM. We'd be like very specific about looking up rules.
Yep.
It'd be something maybe closer to what Quinn's Quest is doing with their podcast Play to Find Out, which Quinn's is like very hyper specific on going in and making sure they play like rules as written, because they want to see how the game is actually played.
Yeah.
Like, we'll mess up rules. Like, pretty much every interview we ask the designer, like, hey, what rules did we mess up?
There's always a core one.
Yeah. Our Wanderhome season with Jay Dragon, Jay was like, well, you guys seem to have fun, but you didn't use the core mechanic at all.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, no! Which is, from the perspective of this show being a teaching tool, is a fundamental failure.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think we've pushed up against that cage enough that we've expanded it to be like, now this is more aspirational.
Yeah.
We're trying to get you to be interested in Wanderhome, even if we did all the rules wrong. We've now been a little bit more careful on not messing up that explicitly.
It does make me want to see someone edit an AP where you take the talk back and you intersperse it docu-style, where it's like talking heads about the AP you played.
That'd be a lot of fun. I was thinking about this today of like, what I'd like to do, and I'm sure someone has done this, but do like a director's commentary for an actual play episode.
I don't know what the format looks
so
like.
Neither do I.
That's like what I was trying to do with Party by the Apocalypse, which I put out earlier this year, which was a miniseries I did with Aaron King of the RTFM podcast, Keegan EXE, and Essay of various things. Also, they'll be on the show notes. But we did an actual play where the goal was teach people how to play Apocalypse World, and the way we're going to do that is by like playing the game and very periodically just like stopping and being like, so what are you thinking right now? Like, how is this working for you right now? Like, what's your goal doing this? And like really leaving in all the negotiations around the mechanics and stuff, and then like pausing to do meta commentary on like not just how the mechanics are working, but like I'm making this decision for my character, you know, because I think like you want to be pressed in this particular way. And I think that'll be good drama, right? And I found that format worked really well, actually. And there was still a lot of room to like remove the like boring parts, right? To remove the people just looking up rules and the going around, and stick to the like talking about how and why.
Because people arguing about rules is not a thing that I think is inherently boring.
Yeah.
It can be boring.
Yeah.
And it often is.
Well,
but when it's an interesting conversation, then it's core.
It depends so much on like, I mean, like we're recording this a couple of days after Jay Dragon dropped this new Expressionist Games manifesto, which sort of posits that like this is sort of a secondary characteristic in that manifesto, but that like pro-socially arguing about rules can be like a really fruitful thematic space, right? Like, if the game is built for that. But also, I don't know, often the game is not built for that, so.
Right.
But in a world where, I think all of us at this table have played J-Dragon 7-Part Pact.
Yeah.
And that is a game that is explicitly built to, like, argue within and, like, embrace that and like, really revel in it.
Yeah.
But it's also the case that, like, it feels harder to make an actual play of that experience, right? Especially because I think, like, that experience of like, wrestling with rules in a game where that is intended to happen so often blurs the line between player and character, between the nonfiction and the fiction, which then is really interesting and compelling, and I love that gameplay. But also, I don't know, I'm saying this and then I'm thinking, like, y'all did a Triangle Agency series, right? Like, I'd be curious to hear how that goes.
Not yet. We haven't hit record yet.
Shit. There you go.
We did the Patreon mini series, but we haven't done the, like, big series we're planning.
Yet. Well, I'm in the middle of a Triangle Agency campaign and have a lot of feelings about exactly this topic that I'm sure, I think 2026 is going to be a lot about unpacking on this show. So I'm excited to hear how all that goes on y'all's show, too. Let's move forward. I want to talk about the Wild Sea. We're here to talk about a moment from an episode of your My First Dungeon Wild Sea series. But let's talk about the series at large. Where did it come from? Where did it start from? What is the Wild Sea? And, like, what do you love about it?
Yeah, the Wild Sea was born out of Gen Con 2023. We met Felix Isaacs, the designer of Wild Sea, and kind of got to chatting. And the Wild Sea had just won its Ennies. And then later that year, we started talking to Felix about how cool it would be to play the Wild Sea on My First Dungeon. And Felix was like, Ray Chow is the guy you gotta convince. Yep. He was like, Ray, you know, he's not always down to spend money unless he thinks it's a good investment, but I can help you kind of with this conversation. And so we spent probably 3 months kind of in conversation with MythWorks and Ray Chow pitching on doing the show, what the money would take, how we could prove a return of some kind, because, you know, we didn't have data on what the return would be. Wild Sea is now our kind of case study of data of, like, return on investment for actual play, but Ray largely took a risk on us.
Yeah, to Ray's credit, like, we couldn't prove that we had any demonstrable impact or return on investment. Like, we could kind of point to a lot of indicators that were like, you know, our die series got a lot of buzz and, like, ended up spawning some other die series, and same with our Orbital Blues series, and, like, there were all these, like, kind of intangible markers. They were qualitative, but they weren't quantitative. Okay. And so Ray, you know, very much to his credit, took a significant risk on us, and I think we came to that recognizing that he was taking a risk, recognizing that the Wild Sea and MythWorks, though they are a relatively bigger indie company, are still a very small company. Yeah. And, like, we wanted to meet them with where they were coming at. Like, they were taking a risk on us. We wanted to reward that risk. And we did that by, you know, Behold did a whole album of original music. Me and Jay Stroutman wrote, like, 6 or 7 original tree shanties. We really went hard on our sound design and, like, really made this probably our most immersive season ever? Mm-hmm. And really, like, leaned in on this one. Mm-hmm. And I think we had before, but we were like, we got to make this one work. This is, like, our time to prove that this is a not only a great artistic investment, not only a great qualitative investment, but also a great quantitative investment. And luckily that paid off.
Yeah. How, like, you don't have to get into the data in particular or the numbers if you don't want to, but I'm curious to hear, like, how did you, like, collect the data that shows this was a financial success?
Super straightforward. We had a discount code with trackable purchases, and on that discount code we saw a 2x return on the investment. Brian,
it was like 2.1x, and to be fair, that was as of 7 months after the release of the first episode. I haven't gotten an updated number since then. I probably should. Yeah, so we had this discount code that anytime anyone used it, you know, he had it on his back end. And that ended up netting them, like, an additional, I think it was $12,134 at last time we checked.
Wow.
Dollar, and that was trackable.
Yeah.
And we knew a bunch of, like, on our Discord, there were people who were like, oh, I didn't even know you had a discount code. I bought it because of you.
Yeah.
Or, like, I was just working a booth at Gen Con not too long ago, and I was at the Rowan, Rick, and Deckard booth, and people would come up and be like, oh, Wild Sea, I just bought Wild Sea because of you. And I'd kind of be like, hey, you know, we got this discount code.
Yeah.
They'd be like, oh, shit, no. So that is like the low end of what the reality is.
Totally.
It is likely higher than that, but that is the only like demonstrable number we can prove, which is great. Though, to be clear, if Ray was to spend that same amount of money on BackerKit ads or like Instagram ads, Facebook analytics stuff, it is very likely that he and anyone else doing it who had good assets would get 2.5x return on investment.
Sure.
Or more.
Yeah. Or more. Now, the way that we always pitch it is that, hey, we're getting you close to that, or we've had case studies where we get close to that, and you're getting this polished product that will exist on a shelf forever. Mm-hmm. Like, this is in the library. You can point to this anytime you want. This is a high-end thing that will get more people into the game, get current players more excited, and is a great spot to point people to if they want to learn the game and actually start playing it, which is ultimately what all the designers and the companies that we talk to want. Like, yes, you want people to buy the game, mm-hmm. but you really want people to play the game. That's why we got into this.
Yeah.
That's why no one makes the game, is to play it. And, you know, cynically, a person who plays the game is more likely to buy future games.
I mean, listen, if you're trying to make money, what are you fucking doing in this industry? Like, if you're, like, trying to get by, like I understand, like, being in this industry and trying to make money, right? But, like, if your goal is making money, like...
Yeah, if your goal is to make capital M money, you're doing the wrong thing. If your goal is to make a humble living, you can maybe do that.
Like, Elliot is...
Jury's out.
Elliot's crushing it, and the jury's out.
You also, I know, mentioned just like what is the Wild Sea and what drew us to it. For folks who don't know, simple pitch is the Wild Sea is you are sailors atop chainsaw ships in a world covered in trees that has just been made capital W weird by an apocalypse a couple hundred years ago. And you can play mushroom folk and cactus people and moth people. And it is just
a pile of spiders.
And a pile of spiders that is sentient. Or in our case, bats, because we had a spider line with one of our players. So we had a bat chelicrae, which was very fun. And it is just my favorite kind of fiction, which is weird fiction, weird fantasy. And... yeah, I remember when we were talking about it, because the other sort of shift was that this was the first time we were putting someone other than Brian in the reins of a major season. So I was really excited about the game. I would like everything about the like juice of it spoke to my brain in a particular way, but I was also deeply nervous about kind of taking the reins in that way.
Yeah, totally.
Crushed it.
I'll take that.
Yeah, you should. So I feel like that's like great setup, both like non-fictional and fictional, as it were, going into this moment. But then I just want
a callback. That's a podcast host right there.
Yeah. Look, here we go. But let's like get into this particular moment and like start breaking it down. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Hero Forge and the Hero Forge Black Friday sale. From Thursday, November 20 through Monday, December 1st, get 20% off Hero Forge physical miniatures and accessories. Never been a better time to check out Hero Forge's classic customizable minis. You can get a mini of your character and in a variety of materials, including color plastic, bronze, and steel. You can even get them as a keychain to take with you wherever you go and at the same usable scale. Or check out Hero Forge's custom 3D printed dice, printed using the same process as Hero Forge's color printed minis. Choose your own number, size, and color, and then you can put anything from Hero Forge almost like floating inside the die. Like put a little model of your familiar in there, or a cool hammer, or whatever you like. And the sale is even bigger on digital. Get 50% off digital STLs for your own home printing, and digital miniatures for virtual tabletops. Some restrictions apply. Sale ends 12/1/25. Check out heroforge.com/sale for more details. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Hero Forge and Hero Forge holiday gift cards. Give the gift of a custom mini or custom dice this holiday season with Hero Forge holiday gift cards. Take the guesswork out of gift giving by letting them design their own hero. Digital gift cards are delivered instantly by email, they're easy to redeem, and they can be used on physical minis, Hero Forge subscriptions, STLs, and digital miniatures. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop minis with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser, so you can make whatever mini you want. They come in a variety of materials, including premium unpainted plastic, colored standees, and colored plastic options. And Hero Forge also offers downloadable model files so you can 3D print your unique designs right at home. Or if you don't want minis, pick up some 3D custom printed dice with your little minis floating inside. Hero Forge holiday gift cards, they're an easy and quality gift for this holiday season. You can get yours today. Learn more at heroforge.com.
My dearest listener, have I got a secret for you. Bitterton is an improvised comedy podcast inspired by the stories of Jane Austen that tells the tale of a wealthy family's secrets, scandals, and shenanigans. Lady Bitterton has unwed daughters, nosy neighbors, awful country cousins, and now a body to hide. Will the Bitchertons be able to keep their secrets off the pages of Lady Bigwither's gossip sheet? Or will her pen skewer their good name forever? Oh, Bits, what a predicament. Featuring the voices of Katie Maravich, Iffy Waddyway, Carolyn Page, Alex Songsharp, Brian Flaherty, and Cassie Wilson, plus a dance card filled with guest comedians of the very finest quality. But for us to help the seeds of rumor ripen into the juicy plum of scandal, we'll need your help. Bitcherton is heading to Kickstarter on June 13th. Go to bitcherton.com to pre-save the campaign and help us bring this story to life. Ta-ta for now.
So I wanted to start with, like, background for this moment. Like, what context do we need to understand going into it?
Sure. So this game is it's a Forged in the Dark game, so it's a D6 dice pool-based system. I believe in this clip that doesn't really come up, but one of the core features of this game is a thing called Whispers, which is a resource that your character has that is literally like a word or a phrase that you can whisper, say, or shout, and it will have different effects on the word. By whispering it, you discover secret information. So you, like, learn something about the world. If you say it, you are able to, like, twist the narrative of the world in your favor. So it's kind of like a very nebulous spell. Mm-hmm. And if you shout it, you force a change in the world that often has some kind of high-impact twist that the GM or the other players decide. Mm-hmm. In our game, normally you get to choose whether you whisper, say, or shout it. In our game, Elliot had made a, like, tainting of whispers that now you had to roll a die to see whether you whisper, said, or shouted it, which meant that whispers were these very volatile things where you may have been just trying to use this, like, phrase to get a little bit of information, and you accidentally caused, like, a chain reaction of very bad things happening.
Yeah.
Which was a very fun way to do whispers, having them this, like, weird, tainted, corrupted thing. Mm-hmm. And in this scene, we are all on our ship, the Crackling Heart. My character is a Mothrin who loves singing tree shanties, not sea shanties, tree shanties. Mm-hmm. And we are traveling to deliver some strange and terrifying cargo back to its owner so that we can escape a curse.
Mm. Yeah, and the preceding moment to this clip is that we did an intro after you guys left, a kind of big conflict-y previous episode, and we had done character moments, and the final character moment of this sort of intro to the episode was asking your character, Whistlin, what do you sing that first night where everyone's sitting out on the deck?
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're going to hear in the clip, right?
That's what you're going to hear. You're going to hear an original tree shanty written by me and Jay Stroutman, and then something else.
I had a metal disc piece of amber, and Ezra had the metal rings that you guys combined into a chart.
Yeah, I'm playing with this amber, this piece of amber and these metal rings that seem to be forming into some kind of, like, fancy, like, compass thing. And as I start aligning them at night, they click into place and I hold them up to the stars, and the bubbles in the amber line up to constellations and lead us in a direction.
Damn straight they do.
I'd like you to take the whisper on the right path.
Oh. And I think as he recognizes the path, I don't think there's any choice in him but to sing a song about finding a path. And Jay and I are going to sing it for you.
Give me a chart and I'll sing you a story of sailors that sailed here before. They forged the pathways that all of us follow, so follow with caution, but sail them with joy.
Read not the char for the arrows and dashes. The dashes are foolish, the arrows are lies.
Lies on a char, find the truth in its branches. The branches that carry you into the world.
The world is not kind and the leaves, they are hungry. A hunger that rustles and cries for your soul.
Your soul is not something with which you can barter. You barter with only the things that you own.
Whitland! Whitland! Stop!
The ship tips 90 degrees as you guys come over the precipice of a great whirlpool in the waves. And Kelly grabs you as you get tossed forward, threatened to fall off in the midst of your reverie and in the midst of your song. At the center of the whirlpool is a great pitch black hole you know to be the Whisper Well.
Oh, fuck!
Oh, my God.
What do you do?
So, I want to start, actually not at the very beginning of this, I want to start with the shanty. You'd mentioned earlier in this conversation that you'd written like 6 sea shanties or something for this show.
I think we wrote 8, and I think we recorded like 70.
Sure. Yeah. When was that happening? Was that a thing where you like wrote all those in advance of the game and looked for places to plug them in? Or is that something where it was like you were writing them for specific moments? Like, what was the timeline for creating these things relative to the game?
What I love about this clip is that it is the best combination I can imagine in our entire library of content that most shows pre-production, production and post-production all at once and how those can combine really well. Mm-hmm. Because the reason we had tree shanties at all, I just like liked the idea of tree shanties, but I didn't think we were actually going to like write any. It was just going to be kind of this nebulous thing. And then I said that in like session zero, and Jay Stratman, a phenomenal musician and professional bassist, sent back a tree shanty that like blew my hair back.
Which is Auburn Love, the trailer.
In the trailer song that also ended up being like a key part of the story.
Yeah.
So sent me that, and I was like, okay, Jay, let's just do this. And so we met before we recorded anything, I believe. I think we'd recorded session zero, so we knew who the characters were. Mm-hmm. And I think we wrote in like 1 3-hour session, like 3 or 4 shanties. And we didn't have anything in mind with them. They were just, we weren't trying to like get them to be moments. We were trying to get them to feel like songs that existed in the world. So songs that were about, you know, charts and tides, and were about whispers, and were about things in the world, but weren't like, this is a plot thing. And then I think midway through the season, we met to do 3 or 4 more. Mm-hmm. Because we wanted to have 1 per episode.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which was like a thing I, in like 1 or 2 episodes, kind of ham-fisted in just a little bit. But I was like, we wrote these things, I want to put them in and they're fun. So then we, I think in all cases but 1, we had fully recorded them and Jay had like produced and mixed them and stuff. And so I played the song through my mix board for the players. Mm-hmm. So I would be like, and Whistlin starts singing this, press play. And they'd hear the song, they'd hear the track. And usually that was kind of my like sacred Brian player time. Like this is the thing I wanted to do with my character. I got to press play and I got to watch all my friends listen to me and Jay sing and do a song.
Yeah.
But I would note that this was the one, or 1 of 2, that you sang live on the day.
Was it? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So, I distinctly remember that you and Jay sang this one live. Oh my God.
Do you remember, Elliot, like, is the backing track playing, or are y'all just like a cappella going for it?
This one was a cappella, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah, we wouldn't have had a backing track yet. It was either, it was pretty much all or nothing. And I was so in my head of like, what I'm doing right now is I'm going to perform this whole song.
Yeah.
And this is my sacred time and no one will touch it.
Yeah. He's like, why would you? Why would you fucking touch it?
Why would you?
It's a player singing, which is incredible. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And then this is, keep in mind, the 5th episode of 6.
Yeah.
So I've done this 4 times
yeah.
and it's never been interrupted.
Yeah.
And this time, Elliot jumps in.
Yeah.
And that, A, startles me as a player.
Yeah.
B, startles me in character. And C, allows for this great moment of, in the final product, with the post-production, we have the fully made track, and then, Whistlin, stop!
Yeah.
There's so much that allows me to do as a sound designer, of you can pull stuff out, you can have the creaking of the ship, you can have the
yeah,
of
yeah.
some kind of weird thing opening up. That creates a great distinction between two moments that is like the stuff that makes sound design pop.
Yeah.
So we had pre-production of making a thing, production, we're singing it, and then Elliot now has the chance to interact with this thing.
Yeah.
And then post-production, because of that interaction, that scene probably would have been a bit dull if I had just sung the whole song. Because that's not a very dynamic song. It's just about people liking charts.
Yeah.
And like sailing. Now Elliot made it a story moment.
Yeah.
And not only that, a very impactful story moment that wouldn't have hit as hard if he hadn't cut through something that had been so previously set up to be like a kind of a pseudo sacred space.
Yeah.
That now, well, it was defiled by a GM interruption.
It feels like you really do kind of need that build up because, like, imagine your player shows up at your table and like has a song prepared and starts singing and then you cut them off. Like, that's like the worst thing I can imagine doing, like, at a table. Like, just such a, like, horrible thing to, like, shut down that creativity. Unless they've already done it four times, right? Like, once it's a thing right. Where it's, like, we've given that person that moment, we, like, understand this space. Like, it makes it exciting and, like, gives it all that energy that you were talking about without stealing your spotlight because you've had your spotlight, you know?
On the fifth song, shut up already. We get it. You can sing.
Yeah, this song, that's
this
great.
Is my game.
Three songs, I don't know about that. Five songs, you're right out the door. Yeah.
What's also great about it, though, is that now, fifth episode, Elliot has done this new thing.
Mm-hmm.
So now this space that you once thought was safe and you just listened to a song now can be interrupted.
Yeah.
Now it can be invaded. Yeah. Now there is an additional tension of that is not a sacred space anymore. Something bad could happen in the middle.
Which is very thematic for where this is a story turn for the entire arc of this season. It's like this moment is a turn where in the immediate following scene they learn several revelations about themselves and their captain and sort of the nature of like why they're transporting this cargo that they've been transporting all season. I don't know how spoiler we want to get, like,
yeah, I don't think necessarily we need to be precious with spoilers.
Okay. I know going into that episode, there's a pacing thought where I am like, I have two episodes left.
Yeah.
They need to get all the way beneath the sea to interact with the source of everything that has happened this season. Like, I need to get them down. And so how do I do that? With a whirlpool, of course. And so it's like... A tree whirlpool, which is a thing that happens. But it was a switch in the season where it went from like, we are above the sea, handling our adventures relatively well. Things are scary. Things are like, you know, we're dealing with some like Icker zombies and things like that. Like, things are fucked. But I needed it to be, hey, no more like softball where like everything is just ramped up in seriousness. Yeah. Your songs can be interrupted. Like, this is not a safe place anymore. Like, fictionally, like, table's still safe. I don't, like, that's a loaded word to say this is not a safe place anymore, but like the Wild Sea is not a safe place for you anymore for the rest of the season.
Elliot, I'm curious to ask you, like, when did you know you were gonna interrupt Brian? Is this like a spur of the moment decision? Did you like have this idea in song number two? Like, you know, when were you kind of
blocked? Yeah. When did you think you were going to interrupt my special song time?
It is either in the prep for this session or the session before.
Okay.
I remember, so Shenik Tissera, also of Many Sided Media, produced this season, so was kind of like my guy in the chair the whole time. And I remember the call where I said, Shenik, I think in this episode I want to do something a little risky. And they were like, okay, let me hear it. And I was like, I want to let them have this song moment, but I want to fucking interrupt. I want to just jump in the middle and scare them. Do you think that's all right? Do you think that, like, that will, like, throw the vibes off or whatever? And Shenuk, who, if anybody listens to My First Dungeon, is a little chaos gremlin and was like, no, do it.
Yeah.
No, do it. Fuck him up. Yeah. Fuck him up. Do it.
Do it twice, actually.
And so, yeah, right. And so I had the, like, devil on my shoulder being like, yeah, that's a great idea. Go for it. On something that, like, in prep, I was like, this is a risk.
Yeah.
Like, this is a risk to kind of, you know, table vibe or what have you.
Yeah, what were you afraid might happen?
You know, Jay and Brian put so much work into these shanties. Yeah. And, like, what I didn't want was them to think that I didn't respect that work.
Yeah.
And, like, every time a song got included, it was a really special thing. We always would, like, clap after in session after they played and like be like, oh, this fucking slaps. So I didn't want to take away from like that joy from them, but like thankfully, like, Jay and Brian are not only two players I've played with a lot, but like two very close friends. Yeah. And so I might not have necessarily done that with any player, depending on my experience with them. But I was like, these are two people who I feel I have a certain amount of kind of trust to, like, I'm gonna step up to the line of like GM player dynamics, mm-hmm. and mess with it a little bit, and know that whether they didn't like it or not, I can check in with them after, and they will tell me if it was like, actually, I didn't like that. And I think we leave it in the tape where I go like, Jay, Brian, you okay with that? And they're like, oh, fuck yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, it's I find that navigating of trust at the table to be, I don't know, like the most important thing about playing role-playing games, like on mic or off. And like, it's really tricky because it is just navigating like real life social circles, right? It's just the real life thing. And I think it is really magical when you are playing with people that you trust enough that you know you can take those kinds of risks. And like, even if it doesn't go in a place where everyone is happy, that you'll be able to recover well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know, that it doesn't, that doesn't come easy, you know?
No, it doesn't. And I mean, it comes from, you know, like trying to intentionally create an environment where people feel like they can, you know, we say a thing on the show a lot, which is take big swings. And like, I think we really mean that. Yeah. And I think that like, we try to create an environment for players and GMs where it's like, we'll catch you. You know what I mean? Like if you take a big swing and you trip over yourself, like we will catch you. Yeah. And like, it's gonna be all right.
Yeah.
And like, worst case that could have happened is I go like, hey, Jay, Brian, you okay with that? And like, one of them seems a little upset, and it would have been like, all right, let's stop for a second. Yeah. Do you want to redo that scene? Do you want to do the song? And I can have the whirlpool come in at the end. Like, worst case, that's what it would have been. Yeah. Like because of the kind of relationships and table culture that like we've cultivated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was an element of like, I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't sound weird, but like, casting and building relationships with people outside of the game is kind of, in a weird way, an element of pre-production.
Yeah.
Which sounds weirdly cynical. I don't want to, like, you know, commoditize friendship, but building those relationships, even though you're not doing it for the purpose of like making an actual play podcast or making some kind of artistic thing, is one of the most valuable things you can have going into a project like this, because it's like, great, we have that shared language, we have that trust, we've probably, just having talked to each other enough or hung out enough, we've probably come up to various lines or boundaries that we've negotiated as friends and have found like where each other's good and bad buttons are and where the lines are that we can and cannot go up to.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask about, Elliot, was to dig more into, you were talking about thinking about the pacing of the whole season and like knowing that you only have two episodes left and you know like kind of where the season needs to end, and you're timing this in part around that. And I think that that's a really important skill for a GM to have. I mean, I think one of the benefits of a GM role is being able to put a lot more of the power of controlling that pacing into one person's hands, where it's maybe easier to manage for the group. But it's also, it's like, on the one hand, it's unique to actual play that you know you have six episodes and you know you're like making a show and what the constraints of that show are. And also, like, sometimes you know that like Christmas is coming up and this group's falling apart, or that we've agreed to play for six episodes and actually like Brian has a hard out after that, is like getting busy in his life, and like these kinds of restrictions on how many sessions you're going to play are things that exist in real life too. So just in sort of a practical advice sense, I'm curious to hear you talk about like advice for listeners on being in that position and how you are thinking about it and how you handle it.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And I'd add one other consideration for us, which was budgetary. Like, this was a sponsored season and we had a certain budget we could afford to pay players. And so adding a session just like throws the math off at the small budgets we're working at in a big way. So it's like, it has to happen that way. I think that there is a thing, and I feel like it's maybe a little bit of like a dirty conversation people don't like to have, but thinking about prep for a game is fundamentally different when you make an actual play. Like, it's something I really, really strongly believe. Like, it's something that Brian and I talk about, or like I'll ask Brian, like when we get into a new season, I'm like, like, it's a game can be pitched as low to no prep, and I'm like, okay, is it low to no prep for an actual play, or like, do we still have to do like the prep of making sure that we make a good entertainment product, which is really important to us.
Yeah.
And like, that is one of our like core tenets, is consider the audience, you know, make sure we make something we would want to listen to. And I think that the tension there is that what I'm not saying to do is make your story beat by beat and just kind of push your players into it and you know everything that's going to happen. When I thought about this season, and I want to again give Shenouk credit because Shenouk was right there with me in all the planning and helping me think about pacing,
yeah,
was we chunked this season out into three,
mm-hmm,
and we said these two episodes are roughly going to take place in this setting,
mm-hmm,
and here's the key thing that I want them to know about the world and maybe like a big encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that across three chunks, and those were the only three chunks we knew we were going to be able to fit. And we knew that when we got to the second episode of a chunk, Shenouk would hit me with a message sometimes in session and say, you know, we need to be out of here in the next 50 minutes. So we got to find a way to, you know, push them along, you know, like move the pace.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, that's my, like, my advice is like, chunk your seasons, mm-hmm, when you're making an actual play. Really think about like what those chunks are, and then, you know, you have the freedom of play and the emergent narrative within those chunks, and also you can adjust the later chunks, but chunking out the whole season means that at least those first two you're going to get there, and then you can think about adjusting things as you go from there, but then,
yeah,
you've already thought about pacing and at a blue sky kind of view.
Yeah. Well, I think this is good advice. Like, one of the things I was trying to get at was, like, advice for people who aren't making actual plays, who are just, like, playing games at home.
Sure.
Because, right? Like, I think a lot of people think of railroading as a dirty word. I also think a lot of people just, like, write their D&D campaign and like, you know, shuttle their players through it or whatever. And, like, you know, in the same way that you're thinking about, like, hey, we only got 15 minutes left before our time's up, and, like, we got to get these people out of here, like, hey, that's true on Tuesday night for me, right? Like, people got, mm-hmm, bedtimes. Like,
yeah.
And I think, like, just being aware of that out and, like, trying to plan accordingly, like, it's a hard skill to learn in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And, like, I think it's really, really helpful, as you were saying earlier, to have, like, a guy in a chair for actual plays to, like, do that job separately from the GM who can just kind of be in it. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the things that makes me a good GM, is like having a really strong sense of that kind of pacing stuff. And I don't know. I just think it's a, mm-hmm, skill that people should practice.
Oh, I agree. And I think, like, yeah, if you're thinking about things that apply to everyone, I think WildSea in particular is a game where it gives you really good tools for pacing, in that it tells you to use tracks for,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And I used tracks for everything.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it is a sense you develop of how long it takes to tick a track a little bit in when you first run the game. But by the time I was in the like fifth or sixth episode, I was like, okay, if this thing is an 8 track, I'm going to get 45 minutes to an hour out of it.
Yeah.
You know, if this is a 6 track, we'll get it done in like 30. And then like really practically you can build a 3-hour session out of a handful of tracks.
Yeah.
So that's like, for this game in particular, a good tool. But like, I totally agree like that, like, it is a sense you just have to develop as a GM, that you know what kinds of things take a certain amount of time. And I think you can do your own chunking, even if you're not thinking in a production schedule. You can say like, hey guys, like, this next arc is going to be 6 sessions,
yeah,
roughly.
Yeah.
And then you adjust.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a really interesting tension in here that exists at home games, but especially exists in actual plays, between like railroading and scripting versus wanting to stay flexible, right? Versus wanting to embrace the improvisational nature of the medium. And like, the more you are planning, the easier it is for pre-production, right? Like, the easier it is for a film shoot to like do the thing that a film shoot does or an audio recording session does. Whereas, you know, then you lose the magic of improvisation that I think is like fundamental to this medium.
Well, so, I would...
Oh, good.
I was going to kind of turn it to you, Brian, because I think that I can have a perspective on this, but I will probably be warped because I did the planning for the session.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious from the player perspective, Brian, how you felt that tension came through at the table between like railroading versus emergent.
Oh, I never felt railroaded at the table. And I also have like a bit of a skewed perspective because I'm also a producer on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
In some, like, I'm not cued into what's happening in the story, but like, I'm also looking at the clock being like, hey guys,
yeah,
we gotta go.
Yeah.
And you can kind of hear me every now and then, like, from a player producer perspective, like, helping that, like recognizing the cues that Elliot's giving me and being like, oh, okay, I see. We got to get out of here.
Yeah. Which is a bit of our shorthand. Well, yeah.
But that's also like a skill that I think players just at home should also develop, right? Like, I think that there's you know, I played in a D&D campaign a couple of years ago where I didn't want to do the thing that the GM had written. And like, I should have left the campaign. And eventually I did, right? But like, I just like wasn't on board. And if you're going to be at the table, if you're going to try to engage in the thing, you should get on board with like, what's the plan here? Like, what do you need from me to like make this game function in the way that we want it to function, you know? Like, that buy-in is really important.
I think also the thing that happens when people start talking about railroading versus not. Railroading often happens because a GM plans too much stuff. Yeah. Not necessarily plans too much. Like, you can plan a whole big wide world as long as you're spreading it out over a very long campaign. But if you have 10 story beats you want your players to hit in one session, then it's going to be a railroad. But if you look at Wildsea as a season, the arc of the story is not particularly wide. There's only a few major events that happen. But what that means is that like each episode kind of has one big thing that happens.
Yeah.
Because of that, we have 2 hours or whatever to do that one big thing.
Yeah, and to put your fingerprints on it. Yeah.
Yeah, we can really put our fingerprints on it. We can go down side streets and find circuitous paths to that direction. Mm-hmm. And then Elliot gets to like, any path that he finds interesting is like, great, now we're going to adjust the story to kind of go over there a little bit more. We're going to adjust the story. Like, this beat that was supposed to happen here will now happen over here because you guys seem more interested in this. And also, it, like, still fits my story.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, one thing that more and more as I've grown as a GM, I am much more reactive to players. Like, what I planned largely for the Wildsea was moments that I thought would be great. Like, a couple episodes earlier, there is, like, an Ichor zombie kind of situation where they get overwhelmed with these Ichor zombies.
and
I'm like, I think it would be cool if this weird Ichor I've introduced created a bunch of zombies. Mm-hmm. How's that going to happen? I'm not entirely sure yet. And then, like, we get into the episode and Kendo playing bats uses this twisty whisper method and it goes haywire. And I'm like, that's a pretty good thing to make some Ichor zombies.
Yeah,
maybe let's have that be the consequence of this. So, like, I'm usually thinking in, like, what are the big moments that I like and, like, I think would be cool in this? And then let the player chaos kind of lead that way or, like, shake it up in a different way.
Yeah, cool.
And, like, if that's the thing is, like, if I had interrupted the shanty and there was a whirlpool and they were like, we're going to do everything we can to go in the opposite direction of the whirlpool, we would have done that and, like, something else would have happened.
Yeah,
but it's also, again, like Brian said, everybody at that table knows that, like, man, I bet Elliot's got something cool for us down in that whirlpool, so let's go.
Yeah.
There's also an element of that, just thinking back to our Orbital Blues season, of a time when this doesn't quite work, when the players either misread the GM or decide, like, nah, we don't like that. The whole season, I'm telegraphing that, like, hey, Reno 12 is where the big showdown's going to happen.
Yeah.
But also, it's the most dangerous place you can go to.
Yeah.
And so the players very wisely were like, yeah, we're not going to go there. Like, the place where I'd planned all, like, the third act of the thing, they didn't want to go to. And I was like, oh, okay, let's follow your fun.
Yeah.
And, like, we'll rewrite it. We'll find a new thing. There's still cool stuff happening. The world is still existing. But now it's just going to follow you where you want to go.
Yeah. All right, I want to bring us out of this particular moment and back into actual play at large to kind of go out on. Where are you excited for actual play to push to as a medium? Like, what do you see as, like, the frontier that you would like to see the medium move towards?
Man, I got a lot of thoughts.
I think that I'm very excited about actual play of difficult games, or, like, of games with antagonistic rules text and experimental mechanics and stuff, and what happens when that rubber meets the road of actual play of like, you know, I think that what we've seen in a lot in the last, like, 5 years especially is really, I mentioned those two things about, like, artistic intention meeting game mechanics, and I think we've seen, like, a real breadth of the creativity that people are bringing when it comes to artistic intention, often to games we know already, like D&D, and, like, you know, in the indie space, people are playing in a lot more games.
Do you have examples?
I would put Worlds Beyond Number on, like, as, like, a big example of this, of, like, bringing, like, really epic storytelling with, like, high-class performers to D&D in a way that hasn't quite been done, I think, by the other big players.
I agree.
But they're playing D&D. And so what I want to see going forward is, like, what happens when we take the height of, like, artistic attention and, you know, talent and creativity, and we start bringing in these more experimental, interesting games, you know, Last Train to Bremen, Triangle Agency,
Seven-Part
Pact, The Time We Have. What's that? No, but just, like, what happens when we, like, I just read an upcoming game that I probably can't talk about, but Ryan Kahn is working on a game, the one true Ryan Kahn, who is
the
an
one
incredible
true Ryan Kahn. I want to call out, Ryan came on this show in its first season and did an episode on Wild Sea Whispers that people should check out. So,
I haven't read. Oh, I gotta go listen.
Oh,
to
I gotta listen to that because I love Ryan
that's
and
next
I love Whispers.
In my queue for tomorrow's morning walk.
There you go.
But Ryan is making a game that is kind of taking the whisper and taking it to its logical conclusion in a game. It's called Capricious, and I won't say anything more. You should read it when it comes out. But take these games that are antagonistic, that ask you to fight against the rules, and then what does that look like when we bring them to actual play? That's what I'm very excited to see more of.
Yeah
And not to, like, you know, blow smoke up your ass, but this isn't necessarily actual play, but your City of Winter episode After Image was so interesting and cool, and it was a type of thing that I'd seen in other podcast formats but not in the world of actual play. And that was really exciting to see someone playing around in a genre that I was familiar with from other types of shows, from, like, you know, a Reply All or something like that, but not in the world of actual play.
Yeah. I want to just throw my two cents in here too, of, like, I'm really interested in anyone who is trying to capture not the feeling of improvised narrative fiction, but the feeling of what it is like to play these games, that, like, that the combination of the nonfiction and the fiction elements, right? Like, the fiction is never not going to be a part of that, but that, like, people who are, and I think of, like, Jeff Stormer has been really influential on how I've thought about this too, where he's starting to think of his show Party of One as an interview show, where, like, instead of doing a traditional interview, you're playing a game together. And, like, that really blends the nonfiction of having on who are we playing with what's going on with the game. I think, I just think there's so much, I think that's what's special about this medium, you know? There's plenty of, like, fiction podcasts out there. There's movies out there and novels and, like, other media that in some ways I think just, like, have a huge leg up practically on doing purely that. Whereas, like, what those media are going to struggle with more than actual play is capturing that, the feeling of real life people creating something and also what that thing is at the same time.
I am also very interested in seeing more people, like, 2 years ago, Rowan Zioli said something that, like, really stuck in my craw. And it was, we haven't really seen anyone do, like, the feature film actual play.
Yeah. Until Last Train to Brooklyn, coming next week or the week after on Dice Exploder. Anyway, go on.
But and I know that, like, really got in my head, and we tried to do it with our season of Nine Lives to Valhalla, or, like, that's what I had in my mind. And from that perspective, we utterly failed to do that. but it was fun to attempt and fail.
Well, it was four episodes, right?
It was four episodes. Yeah, it didn't happen at all. Yeah. But I like the idea of seeing more people doing cooler and cooler stuff and taking big swings on shorter seasons.
Yeah.
Elliot and I are the first ones to tell you that having shorter seasons and anthology content is harder than having long form things, because it's harder to get listener investment it's harder to, like, redraw the wheel every time when you've got to do, like, new character art and new assets and start from scratch again. But it is really interesting, especially when there are more and more games coming out that value these shorter, like Last Train to Bremen, one shot,
and the
or 2 to 3 episode things.
The benefit of it is that you get more entry points. It's more accessible to new players. You know, I was listening to your conversation with Taylor Moore about Worlds Beyond Number on Talk of the Table, and he was talking about how, like, we had this huge thing out of the gate, and, like, the numbers have been pretty flat since then. And, like, part of that is because it's really intimidating to start listening to that show. So it's tricky. We could keep going for another year on this probably, but we should call it here. So,
minimum.
Guys, thanks so much for coming on Dice Exploder. I'm excited to, you know, have you back when I'm doing my next one of these in a couple of years or whatever.
Yeah,
thanks for having
me back.
Thanks again to Brian and Elliot for being here. You can find Brian on Blue Sky at BrianFlaherty and Elliot at More Blueberries. You can listen to Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts, and you can buy Elliot's new game, The Time We Have Today. There's a link in the show notes, or Google it, you'll find it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder or on the Dice Exploder Discord, and you can find my games at s.itch.io. Our logo is designed by Spore Garee. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. Thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.